All right, good afternoon, everyone. It is Thursday afternoon, February 11th, 3 o'clock, and we are doing Chem-12BL, and we're starting a new reaction this afternoon. Why am I locked on? I lost my screen now. I am screen challenged. This is horrible. Not the one I want. Not the one I want. I can't get to the control window. All right, hold on. Time out. I may have to restart Zoom. I am completely locked out away from the Zoom controls. And it's not that window. It's not that window. And it's not that window. Found it. Okay, we're back. Lo and behold, when you have two monitors, if one window slides in between the two monitors but does not reside fully on any one monitor, you only see a small sliver of that screen, and then finding it in your billions of windows becomes impossible. I'm going to screen share the iPad, and we're going to start a new lab experiment. So what we're going to do today, if everything is working right and you guys can see and hear me, is to start the multi-step synthesis. And we're making benzylic acid. This is one of my favorite experiments, of which I say for every experiment. I think every time we come up with a new experiment, I say that. This is my favorite experiment. I love this experiment. It has all kinds of really cool stuff in it that we get to do. The first reaction has biological components in it and introduces carbon-carbon bond making in an aqueous environment, and how biological systems actually do that, because we use a biological enzyme, thiamine, vitamin B1, in order to do this reaction in an aqueous medium. We do an oxidation reaction in this one, and we use nitric acid as an oxidizing agent, so we get to see the power of nitric acid and how it does oxidations, and we get to talk about oxidations in general. We also get to do a base catalyzed rearrangement called a pentacol-pentacolone rearrangement that also introduces some nice chemistry. And so there's a bunch of really cool chemistry that's in this. It spans a three-step synthesis that we do over a course of 3 to 4 weeks. And each step of the way, you fully characterize the product. So you do the reaction, you do a recrystallization, you isolate the product, you get the melting point, you get the FTIR, you do all the characterization, and then you use that product as your starting material for the next. And so your yield at the end depends upon all the yields all the way throughout. And the way that the yields work is that your final overall yield is yield one times yield two times yield three. So if you get a 50% yield on the first one and a 50% yield on the second one, then your yield over the two steps is 0.5 times 0.5, which is 0.25. You get another 50% yield, and that 0.25 times 0.5 would be 0.125, or you'd be getting, is it 0.125? Yeah, you'd be getting just 12% overall out of the entire amount. Usually the yields run about 5%, to tell you kind of where they run. And so people are getting pretty small amounts at the end. Although I have seen yields that can be high, that can be 20, 30% on the final step and turn out pretty good. It just takes a little bit of being careful. So what I want to do is I want to start with the first reaction. Let's look at the three steps. So I've mentioned in words kind of what we're doing. We start with benzaldehyde. Benzaldehyde is the sole starting material And two of these are condensed together using a biological catalyst, thiamine hydrochloride. We'll look at the structure of it. We'll work through the entire reaction mechanism this afternoon. That is done in sodium hydroxide, water, and ethanol. It's a long reaction, takes 2 days. It stitches it together, making a new carbon-carbon bond, and makes what is called benzoin. Benzoin is further reacted with nitric acid in the second step in a nitric acid oxidation to make benzyl. And then benzyl is reacted with potassium hydroxide. And I believe that's done in ethanol to make benzylic acid. And so this is a rearrangement that is called a pentacol-pentacolone rearrangement. So this one is benzyl, and this is benzylic acid. So those are our three steps. And today we're going to focus our attention on the first step. So in doing that, let's look at thiamine and talk about what thiamine actually is. Thiamine is vitamin B1, and it's a coenzyme for many biological processes. So it's a small molecule that fits inside a larger protein structure that catalyzes both bond making and bond breaking in many different biological systems. It is in its absence, creates many different diseases or a number of different important diseases. The molecule itself has, hang on a second. I never draw the whole molecule, so I have to cheat a little bit as I think about the structure of the whole molecule. And make it a little cleaner. So this is a aromatic amine that is like one of the nucleic acids amines, and so the nucleic acid bases. And so it's a conserved structure similar to many of the nucleic acid bases. The other part of this system is what is called a thiazole ring. The thiazole ring is aromatic as well. And then off of that, it has an alcohol. So this is thiamine. And the hydrochloride, they sell it as a hydrochloride, meaning that there is an additional HCl that is probably protonating, I would guess, one of the two amines on the aromatic base over here. It's unlikely that it's the sulfur, and it's unlikely that it's the aniline derivative that's there. So they sell it this way just because it's easier to isolate, and it's a nice, stable white powder with a higher melting point because it's ionic. And so it's fairly easy to ship this way. It's related to what is called thiamine pyrophosphate, which is the active component in many of the enzymatic processes. And in that case, this gets connected to a diphosphate. Oops. So this is thiamine. Pyrophosphate. And the important part of the molecule that we want to focus on is we want to focus on this guy right here. This is what's called the thiazole ring. And it's the active catalyst. It's the part that catalyzes bond making and bond breaking. Everything else in this molecule is either for solubility or for binding within the enzymes. And so we would look at the areas over here that have the nitrogens with the lone pairs that we can get some hydrogen bonding in this component. So this would bond to other hydrogen bonding and hydrophilic areas within the protein. The hydroxyl group binds to phosphates, which also bind to other hydrophilic areas within the protein. And then the thiazole ring would sit in a cavity where molecules could come in and interact with this thiazole ring. And then that's where all the magic happens within this molecule. So what we're going to do is we're going to take the molecule and we're just going to abbreviate the molecule as the thiazole ring. We'll turn that amine base into an R group. We'll leave the methyl alone and we'll do an R prime for the alcohol. And this is going to be our catalyst. Now the reaction mechanism that we're going to look at is probably the largest reaction mechanism that you've looked at yet. And one of the things to keep an eye out for and watch for is that so far what we have shown is that when we want to make a new carbon-carbon bond, we had two ways to do it. One way was to take and make a Grignard and react that with some leaving group on some other R group. And it was inherently an SN2 process that allowed us to make the new carbon-carbon bond. The other way is that we've used acetylides in the same concept, doing SN2 and making that new carbon-carbon bond. Both of these needed to be excluded from water because they're such strong bases that water is incompatible with these. But this reaction that we're about to look at with the thiazole is done in water. It's done in an aqueous environment. In fact, the first addition that we do is we add water to it. So let's take a look at this reaction mechanism and see how it starts. When we draw this reaction out, we said that our reaction starts with benzaldehyde. It's two equivalents of this. We use the thiamine hydrochloride. It's in water, 95% ethanol, and sodium hydroxide. And whenever we start a new mechanism, one of the key steps into figuring out a mechanism and how a mechanism starts is to look at the reagents that are used in the reaction. This reaction starts off with base. And the rule of thumb is when a reaction starts with acid, look for something to protonate. When a reaction starts with base, your first step is a deprotonation. So That's what we're going to do is we're going to start our reaction mechanism off by looking for a deprotonation. And the first thing that we're going to deprotonate is our thiazole ring. No, I put the double bond in. Okay. So we got to find a proton that's an acidic proton on this molecule. And it's not going to be on the R or R prime groups because I've already, you know, hidden those. So that means that it's only two choices. We have the methyl and we have the proton that is right here. So we have very few choices, but this is actually our acidic proton. And so we're going to use B minus as a general base. I know we're throwing in hydroxide, but we're going to have a number of different acids and bases that are going to come into play in this chemical reaction. And so I'm just going to use B as a general base, meaning that anything in solution that can act as a base could operate as B. This oftentimes throws students for a loop and they want to know what B actually is. And the idea that anytime you see something as acting as a base, that could be B, could be any of those things. So what we create is an anion, but it's a unique kind of anion. This is called an illid. An illid is a type of Zwitter ion. So I'm using a term that you don't know to describe a term that you don't know. A Zwitter ion is a molecule that has both a positive and negative charge in the molecule. An illid is where the positive and negatives are adjacent to each other. That's what an illid is. And because of the positive and negative charges, I guess I'll just leave illid over here. Because the positive and negative charges being adjacent to each other, that stabilizes them. There's also an additional stability force, and that is resonance with the sulfur. And you say, well, wait a minute, sulfur has 2, 4, 6, 8. Sulfur already has an octet. But we've seen many cases where sulfur can go above its octet. We've seen molecules where sulfur has bonding patterns like this. This is 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12. This is a 12 electron exception. So sulfur can do 8, 10, 12. It has many different bonding patterns that sulfur can actually do using its d orbitals because it's in period 3. So it can accept these electrons in a resonance form and expand its octet, and that also helps. So we get stability from the illid, and we get stability from the sulfur resonance in making this thing more stable. And even though it's stable, it's also a good, I gotta pick a color, let's just pick this color. It's also a good nucleophile. And we have a good electrophile in solution in the benzaldehyde. The polarity of the carbonyl activates the carbonyl carbon for nucleophilic attack. And the anion here attacks the carbon, the bond breaks and shifts electrons up onto the oxygen. And so our illid winds up making a bond with benzaldehyde. So that's our first step. Then that base that had picked up the proton, we're going to give the proton back to the molecule and protonate this alkoxide anion. So our next step is a protonation step. Yeah, let's do it that way. Once we protonate this, then there is a corresponding deprotonation. And so the whole thing is just sort of acid and base driven. The base that we generate takes a new proton. And we have a flow of electrons that go from the proton into making a new carbon-carbon bond. So we're going to make a carbon-carbon double bond here. The electrons that are in the existing carbon-carbon double bond need to break and go someplace, and they go onto the nitrogen and they alleviate the positive charge. So the nitrogen goes back to being a neutral nitrogen. We now have a double bond. With the thiazole ring. And why does it do this? Well, it's being driven by the stability of each one of these intermediates, and that now we have a neutral molecule. And so we've gone from something that was ionic to something which is now neutral in charge state. And so we've gone to a lower energy in that regard. But this molecule has two really interesting functional groups in it. The two functional groups that are here are this one. That's a poor color choice. Let's try this. That'll work. What functional group am I highlighting? I'll draw it over here. It's an alkene and an alcohol. An ene, all, alkene and alcohol. And then there's another one that's here. And this one is an ene and an amine, so this is an ene amine is the name of the two functional groups. Now remember the nature of enols. Enols generally tautomerize to their ketones, right? And the way that they tautomerize is the lone pairs exert a push, which pushes in to make a carbon-carbon double bond, and this one reaches out to grab a proton. And it does that by creating a partial minus, right? So there's a partial minus that's on the end of this carbon here that acts as a nucleophile. Well, enamines have the same thing. They can reach out and they can grab a proton, meaning that they have a partial minus on the end. And so both of these act as nucleophiles. And yet this is how the aqueous chemistry works. is it works by not having a full negative charge, not having something like a Grignard or an alkynyl anion, where these are small hard anions that will react in water and quench in water. These guys, enols, enamines, these are perfectly happy in water and will sit there all day and interact in other ways where they can make new types of carbon-carbon bonds. The question is, which one is stronger, the enol or the enamine? Which element is more willing to donate its electrons? Is oxygen more willing to donate electrons, or is nitrogen more willing to donate electrons?
Nitrogen.
Nitrogen, yeah, because of the electronegativity. Oxygen is more electronegative, holds its electrons more tightly, which means that nitrogen is more willing to donate its electrons, which means that the nitrogen down here, this is the stronger nucleophile. And so what happens is another benzaldehyde, which we'll use blue for, which is hanging out in solution, it also has the partial positive and partial minus. The electrons push in from the nitrogen and out from the double bond. The bond breaks and electrons lift onto the oxygen, and we make a new carbon-carbon bond between the carbon of the old benzaldehyde and the carbon of the new benzaldehyde. And so in this way, we are stitching the two benzaldehydes together. We reform the positive charge on the nitrogen. We've made a new bond that is between the two benzaldehydes. And now we bring that acid, the BH, back in. And we protonate the O minus. And it just takes some patience to sit down and draw them all out. I had a small whiteboard that I would do this reaction on in lab. And I usually have to go around that whiteboard like twice, three times, depending on how big I'm writing, to fit all these components in. Okay, the last step in this is where that base now abstracts another proton. And this time it takes the proton connected to the first oxygen. These electrons push in to create a double bond. That breaks this bond, sending the electrons back to the thiazole ring to regenerate the catalyst. along with regenerating the catalyst, we have now generated the carbonyl. We have the new bond that we've created between the two benzaldehydes. I'll draw in that proton there so we don't lose it. And that guy is benzoin. And we have also generated HB. And so if we're tracking everything, I'll zoom out. If we're tracking everything, the thiazole is catalytic because we generate this illid and the illid is regenerated at the end. So the illid can keep going through this cycle many, many times. But the base actually winds up being used up. The base is not catalytic. The base is stoichiometric, and we use an equivalent of base every time we stitch one of these molecules together, essentially. And the thiazole is constantly catalytic. All right, so one of the things that I'd like to do is, since I've gone through the entire reaction mechanism, is put names to each of the steps so that we can understand each step. And so I just go back and just add a name to each step. The first step is a deprotonation. The second step is called nucleophilic attack. The third step is a protonation. The fourth is a deprotonation. The fifth step is another nucleophilic attack. And then we have a protonation. And then a deprotonation with loss of leaving group. And pretty much, this is the way it enzymatically works within the body as well for many of the reaction mechanisms that it does, either this way or in reverse. So you can imagine this working in reverse to take apart molecules in the same way that it's putting them together, and the thiazole doing its job in this catalytic job with a series of protonations and deprotonations all happening within aqueous chemistry. And it really is this idea here of an enol or an enamine that allows it to function in the way that it does, and the illid. So it's really the combination of both of those two functions, the enol, the enamine, and the illid, that allow it to do all of these jobs. And so some pretty cool chemistry that the thiamine actually winds up doing. All of these steps are reversible. And all of these steps take a while to do. This reaction takes 2 days at room temperature. And so we just generally just let it go for 2 days until we go through and get crystals and then isolate. And hopefully at the end of the reaction, the benzoin is a solid. It is less soluble in the aqueous system. And so this solid precipitates out. And because it precipitates out of the reaction solution, it drives the reaction forward by Le Chatelier's principle. Anytime you remove a component, the Chatelier's principle then kicks in and makes more of that product once it's removed. So by precipitating and removing itself, it actually helps to make this reaction go forward. All right, that's the whole reaction mechanism, which is a lot. I mean, there's a lot of writing that's in there. And I'm always torn between writing the rest of the notes that I want to write and getting those notes out of there and cleaning it up so that we don't have all of that. But I think in the construction of those notes, I think it's good just to leave them all in there for now. This reaction is not like the Grignard reaction. The Grignard reaction was kind of fun to do. It had color changes. There was a lot going on. You got to see the reflux. You got to see all kinds of things. This reaction, we don't get that same satisfaction. This reaction is literally this. The process, when we look at the procedure, we're doing the reaction in a 25 mil Erlenmeyer flask. We are weighing out 0.30 grams of thiamine hydrochloride. Into the 25 mil Erlenmeyer. We add 0.45 milliliters of DI water. And swirl the flask to dissolve it all. We add 3.0 milliliters of 95% ethanol. And again, swirl the flask. You'll get some precipitation at this point because you're at the threshold limit of solubility for the thiamine hydrochloride. The thiamine hydrochloride being a salt, if you try to put a salt directly into 95% ethanol, it's not gonna go. But when we add in this DI water, the 4.45 mils of DI water is supposed to help with that solubility and keep it in solution. So we're right at that threshold. Then we take and we add in 0.90 milliliters of 2 molar sodium hydroxide aqueous. And again, swirl. The flask turns bright yellow. And fades to a dull yellow over about maybe, I don't know, 3 minutes. Doesn't take very long. It's pretty fast. Then what we do is we tear the flask with all those materials in it. We add 0.90 milliliters of benzaldehyde. Reweigh the flask and get the mass of benzaldehyde. The starting mass of the benzaldehyde is your theoretical yield of the benzoin. Because if you go back and you look at the reaction, and we take just this first reaction, let me see. This is C7H6O. This is C14H12O2. It's exactly twice. You haven't lost any elements. So whatever your starting material was here, the amount of mass of the benzaldehyde is your theoretical mass that you could get of the benzoin. And so calculating the percent yield is really easy because there's no limiting reagent in this. The thiamine is a catalyst. So we don't have to worry about limiting reagent in regard to this reaction. So calculating this reaction is really easy. And then we just set it for 2 days allow to stand for 2 days. We don't even stir it. And then we do the workup. And the workup is pretty simple too. All we do on the workup is we filter it, wash with water, and recrystallize. Actually, I think I'm going to add one step in here. Let's ice it. Just make sure that everything has precipitated, that we can get to precipitate, so we get a max yield. Filter it on Hirsch, rinse with 1 mL DI water. Take mass. This will give you your percent yield. Get a melting point. Oh, recrystallize. Recrystallize. After recrystallization, we'll take a melting point and we'll take an IR. And that's pretty much it. So the first reaction isn't a whole lot. And what I did yesterday, screen share, second desktop, share sound. Multi-step and join. This is where I left it yesterday.
Okay, that is it for this synthesis. This is a really short, easy little synthesis in order to do. We have the benzaldehyde now in our 95% ethanol aqueous solution with base, thiamine hydrochloride. The thiamine hydrochloride is going to catalyze the condensation of the benzaldehyde to form benzoin, and we're just going to let it go for a couple of days. So we're going to put a good label on this that indicates what the chemical reaction is. I'm going to set it up in the fume hood for a couple of days, and I think I'm going to try and see if we can get a time lapse over those couple of days. We'll see how that goes. Fingers crossed that that actually works out. All right, other than that, we'll see you back here for the isolation when those couple of days are over.
All right, so that's where we left it. And I set up my old cell phone. I dug my old cell phone out that has a crappy old battery, and I plugged it in and I set it up on a stand, and I'm shooting that time-lapse video over the couple of days. And so hopefully it will crystallize, and we'll see that crystal formation and when it actually kicks in and starts. And we'll go from there. So I envision this lab taking a couple of weeks to be able to do. And it is gonna be one entire lab report over these three labs. So we don't write a separate lab report for each step. We write one lab report over the entire thing. And it's a fairly big lab report. And to help with that, if we go online, I have some resources under chemed.study, under the lab portion, where I have the formal report guidelines. I also have multi-step synthesis of benzoic acid. And here is everything you need for the report. And so it's basically a checklist of all the different parts that you need. So you have your title, you have your byline, you have your abstract, what needs to go into the abstract, what the introduction should focus on, what your experimental section should look like, the results that you should have. The mechanism of the oxidation is not given in Pavia. And I didn't want to put all the mechanisms in here because I'm going to do the mechanisms. We just did the first mechanism of the benzaldehyde condensation. The oxidation is not supported in Pavia. And so I wrote out sort of an oxidation scheme here to show you what that reaction looks like. It tells you what you should focus on in addition to those things, your conclusion, and then the other pieces of information that you need to have in order to complete it. So this is sort of like your checklist for this reaction, for this sequence of reactions, for what you need. And we'll go over that as we get closer to writing up this formal report and as we get through all the rest of the reactions. So I'm going to break it up into a couple of days. I need to let that reaction finish running anyway, which will finish running over the weekend. And hopefully I'll get that first video put up for you guys after the weekend. So you can see the benzoin synthesis. And then I'll do the benzyl synthesis. And then we'll do the benzylic acid synthesis. We'll put all those together and watch the videos and take notes in the lab notebook, just like we were doing before. So that's the game plan. So a little bit shorter on today's lab, not a whole lot on today. What they did in the morning though, is that there was a bunch of questions regarding the lab report that's due for the Grignard. And so I'm perfectly willing to entertain questions on the lab report for the Grignard if you have questions in there as well. And we can do that now, and we can do that here. What I will say is that people were really stressing. Some people had not written a formal lab report since high school. Some people in Chem 1B and in Zaruba's class did not really write formal lab reports if you had Albie. If you had Peter Nemes, Peter had people writing formal lab reports, and Peter was doing a really good job of instructing in lab reports. And so maybe you have more experience if you're coming out of Peter's class, which is great. My take on this is that I'm trying to train you guys how to write a formal that is sort of bridging, getting you to the point of thinking about how do I write an actual publication. And there can be a lot of anxiety on that. And what I want to do is try and take some of that anxiety away. That in all reality, I've put 20 points on this lab report, which is not a huge amount of points. I'll probably give it a score for this round, and then I'll probably kick it back to you and ask you for edits, and then I'll probably put a higher point value on it and regrade it with a higher point value on it after you've gone through and done the edits. And so I see sort of also an iterative working process on these lab reports in order to help you to learn how to write a better lab report. So oftentimes students will come to me and say, can you read this before I turn it in? And I think what I'm trying to say to you is don't worry about having me read it before you turn it in, because I am going to read it and then I'm going to kick it back to you. And so you'll have comments and you'll have things, and then you'll be able to go back and do some edits on it. And so that's the process that I've sort of built into it. Okay. So how about any questions maybe for that Grignard formal or anything that I can help you with now? Or questions in lecture if you want to deal with any of those. You're welcome, Ashley.
I think I had a question.
Sure.
I just want to re-clarify what you said about the methods and materials and like which parts we can actually like take from that guideline.
Yes.
Was it just like the first few sentences? That was pretty much spot on to the lab, that the Grignard.
Let me see if what I can do. Is open this. It won't let me open it the way that I want. Download, preview. Ah, it works differently than Safari. and airdrop it into the notes. Okay, so that part is in here on this page. So I'm going to chunk out that page, and I'll chunk out these pages that come after. And if I need to, I can bring these back in later. Okay, so the question is, Grignard formal. What can we use from the template online, or the formal guidelines? Online. And the answer is that this part here is specific to your experiment and can be used if you want. The infrared spectrophotometry was done using a different apparatus, and I need to get that to you quick, I guess. And so we have a different spectrophotometer. I'm going to fix that today and get that up to you. The rest of this was not used. And then all of this in this next part is your experiment. The only difference is that you would need to change the numbers to represent your material. But this is how we would write a procedure, and it's the modeling that I would like for you to use and how a procedure should be written. And so all of that can be used if you so desire, or you can rephrase it. But that's how a procedure is generally written out. And I guess I deleted that last part. Let me go back and grab. Skipped onto the other page. This is easier than deleting everything. And so all of that part two that goes with it. And that's that characterization part that comes at the end of the procedure. Now, some students have asked me, and they said, well, is it okay if I just reference the book? And the answer is yes, that you could substitute into this part. You could say, this is an or, the procedure in Pavia and you put a reference number up here and that would be your reference. And so you would give the page numbers, was followed without modification. And then this piece would come in there at the yield and give your yield, and you would list that after that sentence. And so I think that what I'm trying to do is I would like for you to learn how to take the procedure that's written in Pavia that is very verbose, that is very wordy, and to boil it down into a paragraph of steps that tells you exactly what needs to do, what you need to do. And so I'm trying to get you to learn how to do this. And I won't give you this model for the next ones that we're doing. So rather than just copying this, learning from this is important. Or you could write the procedure and probably it was followed without modification. I've always allowed that as a substitution as well. Okay, does that answer the question? Yeah, perfect, okay. And it's in the notes now. So now you know where to find it. You can go back and you can look and see what was highlighted. All right, anything else that I could do for you guys? We could also spend some time, if you so desire, treating it like office hours and doing other problems. Or we can call it a day, having communicated all of the knowledge that I need to today. My thing is always not about wasting your time. So I know that you've got a lot of other classes and other coursework and jobs and parents and siblings and in some cases kids, and everybody has things to do. I'm okay with that too.
Like, I feel like I have questions for the formal report, but to be honest, I haven't started the formal report. So
yeah. So you don't know what questions you might totally have yet or how to formulate them. Yeah. Okay. I can certainly understand that. So I will do my best to be available to answer emails and things. I'm going to have some things that I'm going to be running around and doing. My grandmother is still alive. My grandmother is 103. And I need to go and get her COVID shot this weekend. So that's what I'll be doing on Saturday, is driving her around to try and go get her COVID shot. So I've got a bunch of things that I'll be doing this weekend. But in between then, I'll be checking my phone a lot, and I will keep my iPad with me, and I will try to answer questions as they come up. But keep in mind too, that it's an iterative process. And so yes, while you're trying to do your best, try and do your best and know that it's going to get kicked back to you with requests for changes. And then that will sort of be answering those questions. Okay. Score.
Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. Let's maybe call it quits here then. And if anybody wants to ask anything off camera, off recording, I'm happy to do that. And other than that, I would say have a wonderful weekend. And don't forget, I put up that quiz, and I'll probably try and get some other problems up for you guys to work on as well, so that you've got things to do. Okay, we'll keep you busy.
Thank you.
All right, take care, you guys. Stop share, stop recording.